Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor, and I have a special guest in the studio with me today, David. Say hi, David.
Hi.
And we are going to be foraging far afield today. Normally, this time of year, we would be out just looking for the beginnings of ramps and fiddleheads and morels. And foraging, like much in life that is worthwhile, depends on quiet observation, on noticing a sliver of green or a shape of brown. It's like reading a poem or a difficult text. You begin by noticing a word or a phrase that jumps out or confounds, a pattern or repetition of meaning or sound, or like a painter or photographer surveying a landscape or a face and looking and seeing patterns of light, lines, contours, contrast, color. As I said, I intended today's show to be dedicated to the ramp and fiddlehead fern and possibly the morel, that elusive crenellated fungal delicacy that grows around dead and dying elm trees. Are there really any other kind around here? Old apple orchards as well. But something came up. And we'll be shifting that show to next month, and we'll have recipes and other fun things to do. But as the fiddleheads are starting to come up now and the ramps are up, I thought I'd give a few words there. The fiddleheads are the young fronds of the ostrich or bracken fern, and they resemble the scroll work on fiddleheads. They should be in full force in about a week or two, and the ramps have started early this year. If you want to go out and find some, a few words here at the top of the show. The weather has brought up a lot that's early this year. The magnolia trees are in their full glory. The forsythia have exploded in yellow all over our listening area, and the daffodils and crocuses are already starting to fade. But so much else is up now that these displays, usually against a brown, mucky landscape, don't seem as striking as they did past years. But the ramps are up, and for those of you who don't know this stinky springtime delicacy, it's also known as the wild leek. It's usually the first green edible to come up. Comes up in sandy, well-aerated soil, along riverbanks or sparsely forested areas around here. The plant has two spear-shaped leaves on white stalks that seem stained purple near the base. To harvest them, you need a trowel because they grow deep, and their bulbs are delicious. They're garlicky and oniony, and easy to go online, find pictures of these guys. They could help you if you think you've got some. Take a little taste off a leaf. It should be sharp and distinctly oniony. They're up now, so go and get them. But a word for the conservationists. Be conservative in your foraging for ramps. They take a long time to propagate, and it's easy to wipe out a patch through over-harvesting. Take no more than 10% of a patch if you come across them. And if you see that your spot's already been picked over, move on to someplace else. When you eat them, be sure you won't be attending any fancy dress balls or parties that day. They tend to stink. It'd be like eating whole cloves of garlic. It's wonderful, but certain people find the smell offensive. So if you have recipes, questions, or anything ramp, fiddlehead, or morel related, feel free to email us at WGXE, and we'll cover it next show. But I shelved this because I stumbled across a festival of observers, noticers, and pattern seekers just outside the beautiful city of Hudson, the 2012 Columbia Green County Science Expo at Columbia Green Community College. Kids from every school district in our area, from 5th grade through 8th grade, brought their science projects on a beautiful Saturday morning to Columbia Green Community College. And I was so impressed with what these kids did and the pride and the effort that they showed in their work that I just had to talk to them. And they've covered everything from energy and the environment. These were really hot topics. They were projects on guns and ballistics, medieval siege engines. There was one boy made an actual comet, it was just fabulous. All these kids learning the scientific method, learning to observe, learning to analyze. The next time you hear somebody complain about kids these days, go back and kind of just remember this show. It was something else. The kids were just remarkable. And the next time you hear someone complain about how overpaid and lazy teachers are and how they get outrageous perks, like health care and sick days and vacations, ask that person when was the last time they volunteered to go to work on a Saturday for free with other people's children. So today's show is going to be intellectual foraging with children of Columbia and Greene County. Every school district around here was represented. And we're also going to play part two of my 37-part series of an interview with Tim Davis. It somehow fits. He somehow always fits into the show. Tim went out photographing in late January with an old-fashioned plate camera. And as interesting as you think an audio recording of a man taking pictures would be, this was even more interesting. So before we start, I'd like to do a segment we call product recalls. The FDA has a list of food and drug products every month. It's updated. And these are things you should not eat or should take off your shelf if you got them. So today, helping me with the product recalls is David Factor. David, we just have a few today. Why don't you start up? What are we not eating?
Well, we're not eating El Ranchero del Sur Los Corrales cheese.
We're not eating that
because of Listeria monocytogenes.
Listeria, yes, it's a common contaminant. Going
public.
What else we got?
Beef stew mix.
Beef stew mix. What could possibly be in beef stew mix?
Undeclared milk.
Undeclared milk. Oh, you got to declare the milk. Go on.
Gerber, Gerber Good Start gentle powdered infant formula. The product might have an off odor.
Okay.
Goya, Great Value, Hatui,
Gesundheit,
and more. Malta beverages.
Ah.
The bottles may break during opening.
So people who do not want shards of broken glass in their malta beverage should avoid this product until further notice.
Rely, dried yellow croaker.
Wait, dried yellow croaker?
Yes.
What do you think a dried yellow croaker is?
I'm going to imagine it's a yellow toad that's been evaporated or dehydrated.
A dehydrated yellow toad, a delicacy in some parts. Go on.
The product was found to be unevacerated.
Uneviscerated?
Eviscerated, yes.
I prefer all of my dehydrated yellow toads to be well eviscerated, and you be advised as well to eviscerate all your amphibian dishes. And anything else?
Renistart.
Uh-huh.
Pediatric medical food.
The pediatric medical food by Renistart. Go on.
The product was incorrectly labeled as another product.
Ah, so maybe like hubcaps or... probably not, no. Okay. Well, thanks, David. That's it for the recalls today. Now, the reason I was at the expo was because you were showing your science project.
Yep.
And it was just remarkable. How many kids did you think were there?
Fifth.
Go on.
In the fifth grade alone, there must have been at least 15, and there were four tables.
Wow, yeah.
So, 60 yes. kids?
Yeah, there were at least 60 kids. And parents and teachers and administrators. So I just couldn't resist. I ran home and got my digital recorder, and I just talked with these kids, and they were fantastic. But I want to just read a list of some of the people that were on the steering committees for all the schools in the area who had children and students on a Saturday, beautiful Saturday, just loving science. These are teachers in your community. You should recognize them for the work that they're doing with your children or your neighbor's children. From Taconic Hills, we have Matthew Fuller, Kosaki Athens, Kirsten Fiore. From
Hudson, we've got Diana Howard. From Germantown, Joanne Latore. From Hunter Townsville.
Tannersville. Yep.
Dawn Brower.
Brown.
From Chatham, we've got
Patchy Lead. That's a great name.
Ichabod Crane, we've got Kelly.
Carrie Dugan. And
Caro Durham. Stacy
Sasko and Donna Trunzo.
From Greenville, we've got Anne Mary Conroy and Benjamin Long.
And David Wolfen from New Lebanon. So to all these teachers and to all the administrators that were at the expo yesterday, thanks so much on behalf of everybody. You did a great job. And unfortunately, I didn't catch the organizers' names of the thing. But you know who you are, and you should feel proud about this anyway. So we're going to start out now with just some interview 2012 Science Expo. I'm at the Columbia Green Community College, where the 2012 Columbia Green Science Expo is being held for kids from Columbia and Green counties, 5th through 8th grade. It's a ruthless competition, cutthroat. Only the best of the best science students make it to this event. And I'm talking with three of the participants who have just had their projects judged, Daniel Kallenbens and Thomas Fiebig from Germantown, is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your project.
Well, it was on, we had to build a trebuchet, and we launched balls with the trebuchet, and eventually we found out which ball would go the farthest if launched by a trebuchet.
What do you mean by which ball?
We used four balls, two ping pong balls, one foam, and one golf ball. And the Kiva ping pong ball went the farthest, which was the second lightest.
Did that support your hypothesis? What was your hypothesis going into this?
Our hypothesis was that the lightest ball would go the farthest, but it was sort of right because it was the second lightest, but it was sort of wrong because we said the lightest ping pong ball and not the second lightest.
What did you learn
from this, and maybe some a practical application of building a trebuchet?
Oh, we learned how a counterbalance works.
What's a counterbalance?
Counterbalance is the weight that you put on a rotating object, and it will pull it down, so then the ball would fling up over itself.
Are you planning on besieging any walled cities?
I don't think so.
Do you think you might be using the trebuchet in your neighborhood?
I doubt it, because we don't really have any buildings to destroy.
Yeah, but there is one annoying neighbor that I could knock out with it.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Daniel Kallenbens and Thomas Fiebig of Germantown Central School District. So I'm speaking now with Joanne Latore from Germantown Central School District. You're the chemistry teacher at the high school, is that right?
Yes.
And did you organize this for the Germantown kids?
Yes, I did.
Is this your first year? How many years have you been doing this?
This is my first year doing the science fair coordination.
And how did you find it?
Oh, it was exciting. Lovely. A lot of fun. It was very interesting to see such interest in science at young ages, and for me to stimulate them being, you know, a high school chemistry teacher, a college professor, so the whole scientific method being brought to them so early.
How did you find the younger kids and how they responded in their projects? And you're not used to working with fifth and sixth graders. How'd you find it?
And it was great. It was nice to see the enthusiasm, and it was also nice to heighten their awareness about certain things, about how they should be thinking, and just stimulating other things that they probably didn't think about, just from my experience alone.
Mm. There seems to be a lot of kids from Germantown as opposed to other schools. Do you think there's a genetic predisposition towards sciences in Germantown, or something in the water?
I think I might plead the fifth on that one. I think maybe the water's a fly.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. Hi, I'm talking now with Jackie Burmeister from Germantown. You're in eighth grade, is that right, Jackie?
Yes, I'm in eighth grade. I actually did the science experiment with my friend Haley, but she couldn't make it here today.
And talk me through this. The title of this is called Germies?
Yes, we decided to be different this year. Our topic was we were actually looking on a website to find our experiment. Then we found this one that said to find the germiest place in your school. We changed that up a little bit and found the germiest place in my house.
Oh, and your parents were okay with that?
Yes, because it wasn't like we were doing anything too dangerous. We just mixed together agar, put it in 7 petri dishes, and put it around the house for 2 days for the bacteria in the air to set in the agar. Then after the 2 days, we capped them up and put them in the same place for the same temperature so they could grow equally. And then after 2 weeks, we checked them again, and my brother Sebastian's room actually came in first with the most mold spores.
And this is your older brother or younger brother?
Younger brother.
Yeah. Yeah, they tend to be moldy.
Yes. Yeah. He was a little upset about that. And then our living room came in second place with only 2 mold spores. And then my room came in third. And then the bathroom came in last, but the last 3, actually, the kitchen near the sink, the kitchen near the stove, and the basement dried out, so we couldn't get any information or data from them.
And what was your hypothesis going into this?
Ironically, we thought the bathroom would have the most mold when it actually had the least.
Oh, so you have the cleanest bathroom is the cleanest room in the house?
Yes.
That's comforting, isn't it?
Yes. We actually thought it would be had the most mold spores, and we thought the living room would have the least, but the living room came in second.
So will you be taking your meals now in the bathroom?
No.
Okay. Thanks, Jen. What did you take away from this? What did you learn overall from this experiment?
I learned that the bathroom is the cleanest because we actually clean it. When we don't clean our rooms, like, we clean, like, the bathroom. We get down on our knees and scrub the bathroom. We don't really scrub our bedrooms or our living rooms.
You think that's going to change now?
Yes, because we clean it every weekend.
Excellent, excellent. Sounds like your parents have you guys on the ball.
Yeah.
And so, did you do any special training, or do you have any, like, to get psyched up for this event?
Well, we presented in front of class. We didn't really have any training. We just wanted to present what we knew and look the best.
Well, best of luck. Have you been judged yet?
Yes, I have been judged. The orange sticker, or whatever you want to call it, is on.
Well, thanks very much, Jacqueline. Pleasure talking to you, and good luck.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Abby Nelson. I'm from Deconic Hills, and I'm in eighth grade.
And is this your first year at the Science Expo?
No, it is my second year.
Your second year. And talk to me a little bit about your project here. What's the idea behind this?
My project is an experiment in sustainability. The purpose of my experiment is to see if it is more economical to sustain a house on multiple types of renewable energy.
Excellent. Wow. So very, very modern, practical application. Mm-hmm. And what made you come up with this project?
My project last year was lemon batteries, and I found out that there's electricity in fruit, like lemons. I couldn't get the light bulb to light. So this year I figured out what I did wrong. I had to galvanize my own nails. And so this year I built off that. And so I decided to experiment in different types of renewable energy sources.
Fantastic. And you have a little model of a house here made out of styrofoam.
Yes, I built everything myself.
You did. That's fantastic. And talk to me a little bit about your amazing little house with all the energy sources you have going on here.
My energy sources are solar panels, a windmill, and the lemon batteries. Whatever energy is left over from all three sources goes into a dead battery at the bottom and is stored for a later use. My house stays at around 68 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the room temperature. It gets heat from my greenhouse and goes into the house so it can circulate.
Oh, you have a little greenhouse over on the plants growing in the greenhouse. What plants are these growing?
Basil. I've been experimenting with different types of herbs, seeing what grows the best. And so what I did this year, so I hooked up everything on the inside of my house. I have a hot water tank with running water.
Is it true? She has a hot water tank with running water in the styrofoam house.
It's a year old, so everything's kind of falling apart now. This is my hot water tank. It has working pipes, which I built myself with super glue and plastic. And this is my refrigerator over here. I hook the generator up into the back of the house. I have a cool, damp towel sitting on a dowel rod in front of it. And so the cool air goes into the refrigerator, which acts as my refrigerator. Then the rest of the air goes out the door in my refrigerator room into the house as air conditioning.
Wow, that's fantastic. And that is a really cool towel.
Yeah, it's an eyeglass cleaner. I just had to cut it.
So how many lemons do you think it would take to power, like, an actual house?
About 40.
40 lemons?
I did the math, and it's about 2 minutes for each lemon. That's how much power it can produce for a light bulb, for an LED light bulb, light-emitting diode. 3 lemons can light the light bulb for 7 minutes and 32 seconds, and 4 lemons can light the LED light bulb for 9 minutes and 7 seconds. And I tried cutting the lemons in half, so it's about the same. So I had 8 lemon halves, and that produces enough electricity for about 10 minutes.
10 minutes of light.
Mm-hmm.
So if you scale that up for sort of like
a modern
ranch or something like that.
To run everything off of it?
But yeah, to run every, how, you know.
Run everything off of it. It'd probably take about 100, around there.
100?
Everything off of it.
For what, 10 minutes?
Probably.
I think lemon's probably not the future for energy, you know?
Not yet, unless I can get more electricity from them and make them bigger.
What was your hypothesis going into this?
My purpose of my experiment was to see if it is more economical to sustain a house on multiple types of energy.
Mm-hmm. And how did you do that in comparison with like another type of energy?
The reason I used all three energy sources is for, say it's cloudy, you can't use your solar panels. And say there's no wind, you can't use your windmill. And say you can't get more lemons, then you can't use your lemons.
Mm.
And if you don't have enough energy stored in your battery, then you have no electricity.
And what did you discover after this experiment?
It is more economical to use solar panels, a windmill, and lemons combined.
Than just one of them?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Shelby. It's a pleasure talking to you. Good luck. I hope you do well. You're off to high school next year? Good luck with high school.
Thank you.
I'm Cody Pinkowski. I'm in the eighth grade, and I'm from Hutton Junior High School.
I'm Ricardo Wise. I'm in the eighth grade, and I'm from the Hutton Junior High School.
And your experiment is distillation.
Yep.
This is near and dear to my heart. Talk me through your project. What do you got going on here?
All right, I have a glass flask here full of water that has food coloring and salt in it, and it's boiling, and the steam is being caught. It's going up through a metal tube, and it's being condensed in there, turning it back into liquid water droplets and being collected in a jar. And when it's all done and there's no water left in the flask, it'll be pure concentrated food coloring, and salt is going to be pure again, and it's going to be in the bottom, and then you'll have 100% distilled drinkable water.
As opposed to the water that you contaminated with salt and,
yeah,
and food dye.
Yep. And then it's clean and it's clear, and the food coloring is for demonstration purposes to show that it's going from red to clear, and it's doing that through the steam.
And so they have a beaker, or a flask, I should say, with a rubber stopper and a glass tube and a torn piece of jean?
Cloth.
Of cloth on top. And what is the purpose of the cloth?
The purpose of the cloth is there has to be a cooler surface than what's in the water to condense the water, the steam that's going through. If the air or something cooler isn't on the pipe, it won't condense because it's still the same temperature, and it'll just turn out in steam and just keep going.
As we see now that you've taken this off. So now you put the cool rag back on, and we're getting drips out. So what was your hypothesis going into this?
My hypothesis was that I would change dirty water into clean water through boiling and steam and condensation.
And you found that to be true?
Yes.
Do you see any real-world applications for this experiment?
Yeah. With people believing that the end of the world's coming, they want a way of cleaning their water and making sure that they can drink it. And if water is contaminated and it's undrinkable, they can easily put something together that could distill water and clean it up and make it drinkable again.
So when the people start rioting and pillaging, that you should just grab as many glass beakers as you can?
Yeah, or a really big one.
Or a really big one. thanks for Cody and Ricardo for talking with me and getting ready for the end of the world.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Okay. My name's Mike Sharkey. I go to Cara Durham Middle School, and I'm 14 years old.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about your project here.
My project was a concept that I came up with that involves solar cells on trees. Leaves on a tree move with the sun at not a very large measurable, it's not a very large measurable movement, but it's still a movement. So I figured if I can either attach cells to the branches of a tree or to the leaves of a tree, that I can get the tree itself to move the cells, maximizing the amount of electricity being produced.
Yeah, we see here two examples of that. Michael has sort of a really interesting arty wire tree with multiple colored wires, and at the end of them are pieces of solar panel, and then there's a branch or twigs with solar panels sort of attached to them. So what was your what did you find? What did you find as you're doing this?
I found out that compared to a solar cell being absolutely flat, the cell that was on a tree contained 0.007 of an increase of electricity for the branch, the cells on a branch.
Well, how do you count for that?
What?
How do you count for that?
I was calculating through the amount of voltage readings that I got off the voltmeter, and a few other tests that I ran, because I was figuring the more eco we can be with wires, not wires, but with actual solar cells and trees themselves, if we can get them to work hand in hand and naturally, well, more eco-friendly produce electricity, the better we'll be off in society. Mm.
So do you anticipate down the road solar panels in every tree, or is that not sort of jipping the trees out of the energy that they need too?
Two concepts that I have was, yes, it would jip the trees out of energy, but the other concept that I had was putting up a large scale, almost of a model of a tree that was close looking to a standard tree, so then it looks like a tree, but it's not a tree, and it's still generating the amount of electricity that we need. And if I can do it on a large enough scale, I will actually have part of the electricity going to the motors that will rotate the branches.
Excellent. And what made you come up with this? What sort of inspired you to put this project together?
About 3 years ago, my uncle and I were sitting around a table. I'm like, why can't we take solar cells and put them on trees? Because one particular tree that he has is just, it's in the middle of a field and it's only getting sunlight all day long and every ounce of it. And I'm like, why can't we have solar cells on that tree? And he's like, that's a very good idea. So him and I created a site for it, and we bought a bunch of solar cells, and we never got around to making a large-scale tree or making long strands of cells to put on a tree. But probably about a year after we created the site, a kid in Long Island also had a similar idea.
So your idea predates his idea?
My idea predates his idea.
As far as you know? As far as you know?
Yes.
And this kid got a lot of credit, I imagine, for this idea. So have you learned anything about business? Copyright, patent law might come in?
I've been looking up patent laws lately, but I'm still doing research on it.
Well, don't you think that part of the genius of the internet is the free flow of ideas? And
yeah.
Good luck with your idea. It's a fabulous one. I'm sure in the future, even if you don't get all the credit for it, you can know in your heart that you contributed to the advancement of humanity.
Thank you.
Do you anticipate a future in science for yourself?
I want to become a nuclear physicist when I'm older.
I'll take that as a yes. Okay. Michael, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck.
Thank you.
All right, now we're talking with Sean Daly.
Yes.
Sixth grade.
Yes.
Caro Durham.
Yes.
Sean, why don't you tell me a little bit about your experiment here.
Okay. Hi, my name is Sean, and I had created a comet to demonstrate why comets have tails. Comets generally have two tails, the ion and dust tail. The ion tail is made up of electrically charged particles that interact with the star's magnetic field and always point away from the star. The dust tail is made up of the evaporated gases escaping from the nucleus, forming the coma. And when passing near a heat source, this would have formed the tail. Comets are made up of water ice, ammonia, carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, and dirt, which contains iron. The water ice is basically the glue of the comet. It holds everything together. You would also expect a comet to be very strong and sturdy, but instead, comets are very, very fragile. In the year 2000, comets had observed a comet passing near our sun, and it exploded, causing thousands and thousands of tiny little fragments of this comet passing into the star. The Halley-Bopp comet was said to have a third tail, a sodium tail, between the ion and dust tails. Comets have tails because of it is all of the evaporated gases just passing. When it passes near a star, all the gases are just evaporating, causing the coma and tail. Mm.
And what? How did you make a comet?
To make a comet, you have to just add water, window washer fluid, which contains the ammonia, corn syrup, which contains the carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens found inside of comets, and the dirt, which contains the iron. Then you add dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide at negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and then you hold the bag shut for about 5 to 10 minutes, and everything will just freeze together. You can mold it however you want, and then you pull it out, and you have a comet.
And Sean is holding a comet. You have gloves on. Why do you have gloves on while you're holding your comet?
If you touch the comet with your bare hands or your skin, you will get an ice burn.
Hang on, let me try this. Ow. Okay. This is a truly, truly remarkable hunk of ice and rock you have in your hands. And what have you always been interested in astronomy, or what got you interested in this project?
Astronomy has always been my favorite concept. I mean, when my mom was in college and she was studying the astronomy course, I was out up on the roof with her with my telescope just studying the stars. And that's how I got fascinated with them, because then I started hearing these new planets like Betelgeuse and all these other stars and planets, and I learned about the constellations, and I just got very, very fascinated in this.
How many constellations can you pick out?
Not that many. I can't remember them all. I know Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, Virgo, Leo the Lion, just a few basics.
That's about four more than me. Well, Sean, this is terrific. What did you find out about comets while you were doing this experiment? What did you learn? What did you take away from this?
I learned that comets are very, very weak. I thought that they were very, very strong. I learned that comets' tails can be miles, millions of miles behind it. I learned that they can be many kilometers across. I learned that how to make a comet. I learned what comets are made of, what they contain. I learned a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, you sure did. Well, Sean, I'm so happy my son's not in sixth grade, because I think you must take this hands down. Is this your first time in the science expo, or your second time?
This is my first time being in.
Well, good luck to you, Sean. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, my name is Audra Rosignol. I'm in grade 7, and I go to Hunter Tannersville Central School District.
And what's your project here?
Well, me and my partner Dylan did Hydrolicious Power, and it stands for hydropower. And we tested a water wheel and how much energy it made. And we used a 1.5 light bulb, but that didn't exactly work because the water flow wasn't constant enough. So we attached it to a voltmeter, and it showed the power from the water wheel that it made while it was spinning. And we didn't use water now because it would have made a mess. So we just used our hands and to just show how the low flow, if you went low and you spun it slowly, how it would only get to about 0.0, like 0.02, and then if you kept spinning it, the faster it went, the more power it got.
And how did you construct your water wheel here?
Well, we made the wheel itself out of a Pringles can, and we used popsicle sticks as the wings to catch the water. And we made the base out of thinking, well, we had to have an access for it to spin on. And then we had to show where the water came out of, so it came out of the left side. And then basically it just kind of molded itself to fit. And we used a belt because it made the water, it was just more fit for the water wheel.
And is that a rubber band?
Yeah, that was a rubber band that we used. We're going to have a smaller generator over there. We're going to use that, but it didn't work as well because it kept falling off the rubber band. So we used these plank type things made out of popsicle sticks to hold the rubber band in place while it spun on the axis.
And what was your hypothesis going in?
It was to see if the more water that we use, the force, it would make the wheel light the bulb brighter because of the faster pressure.
And what did you find out from this experiment?
We found out that it did, in fact, make the light bulb brighter, but it didn't exactly make the light bulb brighter because we didn't have enough power. But we found out that if you use this in real life, it would make such a change in the environment because water is a renewable resource, and it just comes and comes and comes. It's not like gold or oil that runs out. So if you use water, it would be so much easier to create. It could create power, and it would be a resource that would never go away.
And were you surprised at how little energy you got from your water wheel?
Yeah, I think we did, because we thought that it would at least be able to light the light bulb. And when we were doing our tests with the littler generator, we were getting pretty scared because we were like, what if the generator doesn't work? What if it just doesn't even do the project? But we tested it out and we hooked it up to the voltmeter, and we realized that it was just that it wasn't powerful enough, and we thought it would be.
So there seemed to be a lot of kids from Hunter Tannersville here. Is it that you guys are genetic predisposition for science? Is it the water? Is it your teachers? What do you think?
I think it has a lot to do with the teachers, because our Miss Brown, our science teacher, she's just so good with teaching us about what we have to do and stuff, and she gave us a free go. She was like, do whatever interests you, and I think that was the real thrive for it.
Kudos to Miss Brown. Okay, thanks very much for talking to us.
No problem.
Hi, I'm Noah Airy, and I'm in grade 7, and my school is Taconic Hills, and my project is propeller efficiency.
Wanted to talk a little bit about your project here, Noah.
I wanted to find out what the most efficient propeller material would be, so I tested it out, and it ended up being the copper propeller.
The copper propeller. How did you run your experiment?
I just tested it with a wind velocity meter, and then I calculated how much air came off of the propeller.
How did you do that?
You just look at the number on the machine.
I didn't know there was a machine to measure that.
Well, apparently there is, because...
You've got one.
Yep.
Excellent. And what did you learn through this whole process?
I just learned that the heavier it is, it might... It's better, and copper is better because it's heavy.
Excellent. You're turning crimson, you realize.
Yep.
Nope. Thanks so much, Noah. Good luck.
Thank you.
I'm talking now with two gentlemen from Caro Durham, grade 7.
Zion Carlson.
And Dominic Manoli.
And your guys' project is
Bullet Velocity.
Bullet velocities. Okay, let's tell me about your experiment. What was your hypothesis, and how did you test it?
Our hypothesis was that the 3006 round would have the highest velocity due to the most gunpowder, and it was used as a sniper rifle in World War I and II, and now today.
Still. And how did you test that?
We measured the level of the gun onto the target. We then measured the drop and put them into the formulas D equals 1/2 GT squared, or gravity. Drop equals...
Gravity times squared.
And then we found the time. Then we put them into the velocity D equals VT, which is distance equals velocity time.
Distance equals velocity...
Times time.
Yeah.
We then found the velocities and put them into our chart.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out the 30 carbine was...
had 2,281 feet per second.
Was that surprising to you?
It kind of was, because we thought the 3006 would have the highest in it. It turns out it was second to last, with 675 feet per second.
Still pretty fast.
Yeah, it is. But I guess we were wrong by a lot.
So what did you guys learn through this process?
We learned that even though some calibers are used in sniper rifles, they might not be the best in range due to the fact that the higher the velocity, the farther the range of the bullets.
You guys hunt?
Small game.
Small game, like what, turtles?
No, rabbits, squirrels, No.
Squirrels?
Yeah.
Squirrels. Little squirrels. I don't really hunt so much.
No. Are there big squirrels you go after?
Those gray ones. Usually gray, red squirrels.
Mm. But no deer or caribou?
No, you have to be 14 to hunt big game.
14, is that right?
I'm almost there.
Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you can hunt at 12, but it has to be with bow. Firearms is 14 for big game.
A 12-year-old with a bow. That's I would bet on the deer.
Or the bear.
Or the bear.
No, it's taking 12 gauge for that.
We did this over. We would for the 243, we would measure the in the right place and take a couple more trials, maybe like put three different targets and, you know, like shoot them three different times at the target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, Zan.
Yes.
And Dominic, thanks so much for talking with us. And good luck shooting those turtles.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
All right. My name is Fabrice Toussaint.
And my name is Kamrul Hassan. We're from Hudson City School District. And
what grade are you guys in?
We're both in seventh grade.
Yep, we're both in seventh grade. Yep.
And this is your project. What is your project?
It's about like earthquakes and what happens. This right here shows pictures of fault lines, some fault line of the San Andreas fault. This picture right here is the edges of the tectonic plates. Right here is a picture of Charles F. Richter, who created the Richter scale. Right here, a picture of the earth. Whenever the earthquake happens, that one part of the land goes up and one part sinks in. And right here is a picture of an underwater earthquake that causes a tsunami.
And here are some tips on how to protect yourself during an earthquake. Drop under a desk or hold it so it won't break, and make sure you get rid of every glass object. And when outside, move away from falling buildings and stay. And when you're in the car, stop on the side of the road and move away from a window and mirrors. Prepare yourself in case of an earthquake. And when you are in your house, stay in the basement with no glass objects, metal objects, and wood objects for safety hazard. And be sure to stay clear and cautious of any earthquake.
I see you've got here some Jell-O.
Yeah.
On foil,
yeah.
Which actually looks a lot like lunch. What is this demonstrating?
This is demonstrating like how like a piece of land would look. Like this could be like a river valley, and there could be like a fault line under it. And this is like mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And so like when you just shake it, see all that movement that happens.
It's shaking like.
Like how city would if it was a major earthquake.
Mm.
This right here.
Oh, and you got another model. You have another model here. Okay, let's see.
These are the layers of the earth, model city, and a fault line. And so this shows like how earthquake could cause. So if a small movement like that just causes a small tremor.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's like a big movement like that, it shows how it causes a huge earthquake and affects a lot of cities and.
Hang on, you can hear the people screaming. No, you can't.
So, well, this is our project.
Did you guys locate any fault lines in Hudson?
No.
There is no fault line directly in Hudson, but it's at a distance. So it probably is, like, right in, like, probably, like, around the ocean area, like, probably, like, in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well... Gentlemen, thanks very much for talking with us. What did you learn during this project? What was your takeaway?
Well, we learned like more information about how earthquakes occur and where they happen, and we had a lot of fun doing this project. And I hope we can do it next year again and put some more information and more work to it and answer some more questions.
Yeah. Do you think you might have a career as a geologist?
No, I want to be a lawyer, so, you know.
I'd be a teacher for science.
You're going to be a science teacher. Excellent. And who's your science teacher?
Miss Howard.
And mine is Miss Antonella.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, gentlemen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, we are running out of time, David. David, did you have a good time at that
Oh, yeah.
Science fair. Yeah. So I think we're going to have to save some more of these. I've got loads of them, and they just get better and better. The kids are so confident. They are so knowledgeable about what they studied. And this stuff can't come up on a little state exam. You know, you really got to see these kids. They were so enthusiastic. And they really rolled with my goofy, obnoxious questions occasionally. And it was just a delight. So I think we're going to turn it over to Jackie soon. We've got Fun Drive coming up. You know, the station needs funds to keep running, to pay my exorbitant salary.
Do you even get a salary?
No. I would be embarrassed to get money for this. This is too much fun, and I think I make too many mistakes. But we're going to leave you. Again, sorry for not getting the Tim Davis and the rest of these. But here's a song by Tim Davis to take us out and to lead us into Jackie's show. You all have a great Sunday.
Does thunder sour milk? And how is a big damn bill?